now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Avast, Miates. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Live streaming today from under crisp, dark, early morning South Korean skies, you're listening to episode 49 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Working to coordinate things across three major world time zones, today's show kicks off a few hours earlier than what regular listeners have grown accustomed to, as we welcome on board renowned author, artist, and filmmaker, Dublin, Ireland's very own Thomas Sheridan. We're confident, though, the scheduling shakeup will easily prove itself well worth it. Among other things, former rock musician Sheridan routinely draws upon his experience as a corporate communications consultant and stand-up comedian in an effort to better bring about liberation and awakening from our modern-day Babylon and its prison planet Matrix. Over the course of the next 90 minutes or so, we'll aim to explore topics ranging from Roslyn Chapel, Western mythology, indie music, the Druid Code, human psychopathy, gaslighting, the age of apocalypse, megalithic mysteries, and the shadowy legacy of Jonestown. Well, gentlemen, wouldn't you know things, as even though we are kicking off here at episode 49, we've immediately run into some technical issues with the slideshow that we're trying to get set up here, streaming on YouTube. Why this has happened, we have no idea. Quite unfortunate, of course, since there were quite a few decent quality pictures that we had incorporated into the presentation that we had planned for today. So how's everything else? So I think we've got, once again, as was alluded to in the introduction, things are set up here spanning three world time zones, as the case, as things are with Ireland and Ensenada over in Baja and here in South Korea. Thomas, do we have you there in Ireland?
I'm indeed here, Jaffrey. Thank you.
Well, that's good. So that's we don't have to worry about that. And Pirate Larry, how about yourself?
All right, Jaffe. I'm here. Okay. Live from the crow's nest.
Okay, well, that's great. I'm going to have to do a little multitasking here while we try to get things off on the right foot. This is really bizarre. Never happened before. So wouldn't you know? Any ideas why that might be, Thomas? Just a coincidence? Maybe a few gremlins in the works? Or
Yeah, maybe. Maybe the full moon, who knows, has brought out Perons on 333, the demon in the chaos, who knows.
Is it a full moon tonight?
I think it is, in this hemisphere, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So that's interesting, something definitely to take into consideration. On top of that, have you found that these sort of strange things sometimes occur with any time, you know, or people try to interview you, or is this just a one-shot kind of deal that...
I get hit constantly. I get attacked constantly. I have had phone jacks fried in the sockets. I've had numerous, shall we say, interference over the years. It hasn't happened much lately because I don't do a lot of interviews anymore. I, I refuse like 90% of the interviews I'm asked on now, so this is actually quite rare for me to do this now. And yes, it's not unusual for me to be find myself in this circumstance. It's not unusual at all.
And the reason that you chose to do our show today is why exactly? I'm not too clear on that, frankly, but maybe you could share that with the listeners.
A mutual friend of ours called Suzanne, who I've known for many years now, and also I like the idea of the way your show operates, and it was just different.
Well, here we go. Look at this, and that's great. Yeah, Suzanne Isles. It's a tough name. I'm not too. It's not the sort of surname you come across every day, but over on Minds, of course, people know her more as Alchemy Doll. So. Big thanks and a shout out to her, of course. Without her help, there's a good chance this might not have even taken place. So, yeah, over the course of the next 90 minutes, then, we're going to hopefully explore a whole range of fascinating and intriguing topics. Where should we start then? You know, one of the things that just came to mind here, too, speaking of synchronicity, is how our last guest, Tom Schaefer, you actually share the same initials as he does, TS, so that was quite kind of jumped out at us. But on top of that, wouldn't you know that actually the 45th show that we did just happened to, coincidentally enough, synchronize with the election of Trump, who, from his end of things, became the 45th president of the United States. Just one of those strange...
Living in interesting times. There's a lot of that kind of synchronicity and stuff going on at the moment. These kind of things happening.
Right. So something that people should maybe take the time to pay attention to and just make note of as these as they occur. So, but you've been a pretty busy guy as of late. You haven't done too many speaking events as far as podcasts go. But what about public presentations? You've got a fair number of bookings on that front. Including a May symposium, I believe, is coming up in London in the next few months. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do. The one I do every year is actually I've come back on doing. I don't do a lot of speaking talks anymore. Again, I've when I first like arrived on the scene about 3-4 years ago. I mean, maybe more now. I was doing events and talking things all the time. I've retreated from a lot of things. I just basically, in the last couple of years, or maybe in the last year, just really want to work on my actual creative output and put most of my energy into that. One of the things I do every year is the AV, which is a big festival, well, a big event organized by Enor Crane over there in England. It's in Milton Keynes in Buckinghamshire. And I do that I've done that about every year for the last 4 years, I think. And that's a very big event. And I'm doing the Glastonbury Festival in England as well in the summer. I've been asked to do one in Houston, but I don't know if anything's going to come of that. Houston, Texas, this year as well. I don't know if anything's going to come of that. But yeah, I do get asked, I get asked a lot, but I turned them down. I'm just not as out there in person as I used to be. I'm much more in the kind of scribe stage now, where I just like basically want to write and create and make films and that kind of thing.
Right, and we're going to get more into that here hopefully over the course of our discussion. But first, right off the bat, speaking of this whole business of not doing too many public engagements or podcast interviews and the like, Pirate Larry, I think it's maybe time that we gave Thomas a bit of a rundown here, overview as to what actually it takes and is required of people to find themselves welcomed aboard the Robin Hood in accordance with the ship's articles, of course, and wishes of Captain Long John St. Clair.
Yes, well, we have a sort of an ancient ritual, so that when people want to board the Robin Hood, first we require a pirate story or a or some kind of pirate joke, or even maybe a pirate jig. And it can be anything related to piracy, just so that we can get some pirate news on the show and a little pirate history on the show. And this may be a last-minute surprise to you, Tom, but do you have a pirate story for us?
I do. Do you know where the Jolly Roger comes from?
Not myself. No, I'm pretty... no, but why don't you share that with us? That'd be great if we could...
It was a code used by the Knights Templar and the Freemasons, the Scottish Rite Freemasons, as a symbol of being outside the British Navy in terms of piracy. Originally, pirate ships on that flew the Jolly Roger were floating Freemasonic lodges. I bet you didn't know that.
Well, how about that? It doesn't surprise me in some ways, no, because we've all already in the past kind of looked at and reflected, kind of considered the possibility that there's some Knights Templar tie-in, of course, with this whole business of the missing Templar fleet and whatnot, and how just coincidentally, and I think this is Robert Homrich, I think, Larry, was it not, who drew this to our attention and kind of made that point, that just as the Knights Templar went into seclusion, they went basically, were forced underground, you know, 1307, I believe, was the date, that from there, suddenly there emerged on the high seas throughout Europe and the West this age of modern
the age
piracy.
Of the pirate.
Sure, there you go. What are your thoughts? Do you know much about that then, Thomas?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened.
Ah.
That's why they had names like Bluebeard and Blackbeard and all this kind of thing. This is why pirate ships, people used to leave the English Navy and the Spanish Navy to go work on pirate ships because they were treated better. There was no hierarchy as such. The captain treated the sailors much better than they would have been treated in regular navies. But that thing of the Templar fleet, big part of that took place around here, where the part of Ireland I live in, they spent the winter in Donegal Bay, which is quite close to here, and there's places around here still have Templar names like Temple Moor and stuff like that. These are all places with Templar connections. They kind of survived in Ireland because we were far enough away from France. A lot of them here were still walking around in in Knights Templar robes, like for 100 years afterwards, out in public, almost like to mock the Pope and the French royalty. So they never really it took a long time. They didn't vanish overnight, like we're told. Philip II, Friday the 13th, you know, edict or whatever. It took about 200 years, and what you had was a migration from that into piracy. But they have histories of migrating, like then when that kind of ended, you had like things being set up like the Dutch East India Company. If you look at their flag, it's the flag of the United States, just not enough stars, but it's the United States flag.
Right.
And they moved into things like that. And then it was seafaring navigation, and then the natural course after that was things like Freemasonry came out of that. And then they even became the first espionage. I mean, that's really what it was. It was the first espionage ring. That's why it's totally tied in so big time to seafaring. This is why Columbus sailed across the Atlantic with the Templar sails on the Santa Maria.
So we have a little better idea than perhaps what happened to the missing Templar fleet. What of the treasure? Any ideas where that ended up?
Well, we have to first consider what was the treasure. You see, a lot of the stuff is code. People say treasure, they automatically think was great riches. It could be anything. Treasure could be knowledge. Treasure could be things like alchemy, alchemical knowledge. Treasure could be things like magical knowledge, the Kabbalah and this kind of thing. Treasure could be the ability to work with numbers in order to create wealth, like a banking or an accounting system. Treasure in terms of how they spoke about it back then wasn't necessarily gold and silver and diamonds, although that may have been as well. The treasure may have been a code word for a secret knowledge that gave them the edge over everyone else.
There you go. So, alchemical, perhaps, as I believe you alluded to, the Gnostic insights or you know, the code, well, who knows exactly, but yeah, more of us along spiritual lines, perhaps, I guess, is kind of what you draw, an enlightened spiritual quality or insight.
Or even in using language, even ways of using language to get people to do what they want. They could have been, you know, they could have been using kinds of like word magic, a kind of early forms of neuro-linguistic programming. When you talk about these subjects, you often were spoken to as allegory. It's allegory and metaphor more times than it's what it says it is. Like when they talk about things like the holy blood, you know, the blood of Christ from the Middle East, or the Holy Grail. The word grail, when you start looking into it, could mean anything, not just the grail itself, which is a cup. But what's contained in that cup could be ideas, knowledge, and, you know, remember, like, knowledge was a dangerous thing back then. The Christians slaughtered Hypatia, threw her body on a fire, and burnt down the Library of Alexandria for a reason. You know, we're talking in a pre-internet time, a pre-publishing time. Anyone who had any kind of, shall we say, powerful knowledge, it was like having the best software in the world and the Bill Gates of their time. And it's only now we look back and think, well, what would be the value of knowledge? Back then, the value of saying having the knowledge to maybe create some kind of chemical reaction, say gunpowder, right? To have that knowledge back then would have given you power beyond your wildest dreams. This is why you had like the likes of every monarch in Europe vying for the attention of Edward Kelly and John Dee just because of their ability, their alchemical abilities. So when they talk about things like treasure or secrets and things like that, very often it's an access to a knowledge database that they had. I mean, if you look at the success of the Arabic world during the so-called Dark Ages, basically what they had done was raided all the Greek and classical texts that they'd gotten in the Holy Land, and that gave them all the powers of things like mathematics. This is what knowledge really means. They weren't joking when they said knowledge is power. And that's why you have the development of secret societies, such as the Templars, such as the Rosicrucians, such as the, you know, the Gnostics, and such as the, later on, the Freemasons. Because if you could hold and secretly transmit that knowledge, you would have intergenerational, multi-century power. When you hear people talk about these subjects, they talk about them in very surface-level ways. These people operated in a way that was very different than us. Their world was completely different. And it just to have an ability to even know a certain mathematical formula or computation system in terms of, you know, banking or money or anything like that, you know, would give you phenomenal power back then.
Absolutely. And there was, of course, as I think most people will agree, great effort to exert and implement mind control over the masses, I think, is one of the things that you've hit on there over the course of your just breaking things down. We've got we had 21 people now down to 19, but two upvotes and one downvote for the show that we're streaming here live today on YouTube. Commentary here in the sidelines, the YouTube chat is heating up a little bit, of course, and we've got Brig Denholm, who we haven't seen around for a while. She's dropped in and wanting to just tune in and listen to today's presentation, as well as, of course, Pirate Joe Emanon. So that's really great. Excellent. The two of you could make it there as far as the text chat is concerned. So be sure, if you've got any questions for Thomas, anything that you like to for him to clarify or work on helping you to better get to the bottom of, by all means, just let's hear it there in the side chat. So Joe Emanon says, knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. All right, so that's looking good over there. What we've got next then, I guess, is probably we want to ask you a little bit about, there's all kinds of different places we could go. You know, one of the things, before we go back to your documentary work and whatnot, although I guess this could in part tie into it as far as your travels to Malta and so forth are concerned, but I know in the lead up to things, yesterday we did just a quick little pre-interview, And we were talking about things like, well, the Age of Apocalypse, and how to people such as ourselves, it means something a little bit differently than what it would to the fundamentalist Christian crowd. And that's mostly because of the Greek etymology, of course. But the Druids, Druids in ancient Britain, but more particularly the Buddhist tie-in. Have you heard anything? Because I know I have. I've looked into it a little bit, and I'm not as up to speed on it as perhaps I would imagine someone such as yourself is. Do you know or have you heard anything about that as far as these traveling monks seafaring, I'd imagine, coming perhaps via the Mediterranean, over to England and engaging in some sort of cultural, intellectual, philosophical exchange with the Druids of Britain?
No. It's highly unlikely.
Okay.
If anything, the knowledge... This is a kind of a Roman colonialist mentality that's imposed upon these islands, in that we're told that the ancients of Britain and Ireland and Western Europe were dependent upon knowledge and wisdom coming from the Middle East and from the classical world and from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
We have that all here. I mean... I would consider at that period Buddhists and Asians to be spiritual Neanderthals compared to what we had in Britain and Ireland at the same time. We no more needed them to enlighten us than we needed Christians or anything else later on. These stories are all nonsense. There's no truth to them. When you really look into the actual reality, what you see are... You see the wisdom spreading out from these islands. You see the ancient mythology of Ireland and Wales and England appearing again and again much later on in stories all through Central Europe, in the Nordic world, and so on. I think that the seat of Western civilization has been done an enormous injustice by placing it on the borderline between the Occident and the Oriental, in the Middle East and towards Asia. The reality is that it was happening here. Our history has been turned upside down, mainly because of Christians, mainly because of this nonsense that it all began in the Middle East. We monkeys on the fringes had to wait until it arrived here. And that this Buddhist connection to Ireland and Britain sounds like more that kind of nonsense. I generally don't pay any attention to these things. They're just continuations of Christianity, as far as I'm concerned, the same kind of colonialist mindset that the Romans and everyone else brought. I doubt it very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, are you familiar at all with the term Greco-Buddhism?
No, I have no interest in, to be honest with you, Jeffrey, I have no interest in Buddhism at all. I'm not probably the right person to be talking about this. My interest in spirituality and mythology is almost exclusively sort of European, yeah, and probably the Middle East or that part of the world. I would not have any I'm not the guy to talk to about anything to do with Buddhism and stuff like that. It doesn't interest me on any level.
Okay, so here's the thing. We talked in the pre-interview once again, this business of, as you are kind of, you know, hitting on here, the migration of culture from, not from the Middle East or the East to the West, but the opposite, in fact, the Indo-European, there's the Indo thing again, as it's sometimes portrayed, but...
Yeah, no, that's the mind control for you.
Okay, but this, hang on a second here. The Aryans now, Tazarian has talked about this, many, I think several others that you are probably well aware of, but the West to East migration to places like, well, the original Aryans supposedly come from Ireland, of course, that's the Ireland, and then migrating to Iran. Does that make more sense to you, the West to East?
Well, kind of. I think the Tazarian is as much nonsense as he is authentic. I think his Irish mythological stuff is pretty atrocious on many levels. It's basically rehashed British Israelism, which is a kind of a fundamentalist Presbyterian idea. He doesn't even pronounce the names correctly of the Irish tribes or anything. But anyway, I'll put it down to simple language for you. What I believe, and I think Tazarian and people like that would probably be on the same mindset, although we'd use different ways of describing it. I believe that Atlantis was an absolutely real place.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence for this is overwhelming. I believe that Atlantis existed somewhere in the North Atlantic definitely was part of Doggerland, which is now sunk between Britain and Denmark. Definitely part of the North Atlantic fringe up around towards Iceland, and definitely connected Britain and Ireland to mainland Europe. It was an expansive civilization that's extended from southern Scandinavia down towards Iberia, Portugal, Spain, through Brittany and the south of England. It is a megalithic culture. They're the ones who built the Stone Circle, Stonehenge, Newgrange, specifically Orkney in the north of Scotland and so on. Something happened about 2500 BC. What happened about 2500 BC? Was it an environmental or some kind of disaster? This is the root, I believe, of the Ragnarok story of the Nordic tradition. I believe the Midgard Serpent was probably the rift in the Mid-Atlantic Rift, caused an earthquake, and you had what you call Atlantis today, most of it significantly falling down below the sea. We have the stories then arising of, particularly in Irish mythology, of things like Tirna an Og and High Brazel, and all these ideas of ancestors who once lived beyond the sea. This is a maxim in all the cultures along the western coast of Europe. And that's what I believe. Those people came with advanced, I'm talking about in that period. I'm not talking about they didn't arrive in flying saucers or stuff like that. They came, they were much more advanced than just about anything else in the world, with the exception probably some of the Asian tribes. Maybe we'll find out later on that North America had like advanced civilizations as well. Certainly Central America definitely did. But they arrived, they basically came to Britain and Ireland, and they had these stories. And I'll give you an example of maxims that throw out that throw the whole east to west thing into chaos, or into the rubbish bin, I should say. One of the primary groups in Irish mythology that arrived here were a group called the Truadh Ó Danann, the Truadh Ó Danann in Irish. Mm-hmm. They were a mythical people that arrived from beyond the sea. Basically, their name means the tribe of the goddess Danu. And Danu was an ancient goddess of these islands. They arrived in the west coast of Ireland in a storm, which suggests survivors from kind of a disaster. They arrived bearing four treasures. Now, this is important because this is the first mention in history of four being a significant number that becomes a kind of a meme throughout spiritual and basically sociological history through the ancient world. The four treasures of Ireland were migrated into the four grail treasures by Geoffrey of Monmouth in the Arthurian legends. Then the idea of four appears all over the Middle East and other kinds of things like the four Gospels. There's four books of the Quran. 444, it appears everywhere. Yeah. The root story of that is the four sunk cities that existed beyond Ireland, which I believe was Plato's Atlantis. And I think that's where it really comes down to. That's, if you want the story, that's basically it. I think there's phenomenal evidence, and it's emerging all the time. Let's talk about Orkney off the north coast of Scotland. Orkney off the north coast of Scotland. The BBC, during their own investigations recently, found an 8,000-year-old stone circle under the sea just off the coast of the Ness of Brodgar. This is turning out to be the Giza of the north. This is turning out to be much older than pyramids, older than Stonehenge, older than everything, slap bang right in the middle of the area where Atlantis should be. If you go by the actual, if you follow the evidence in there, this is, we have pyramids appearing. There's a pyramid on the Ness of Brodgar in Orkney. They don't call it a pyramid, they call it the temple or something. But it was a pyramid. It was a pyramid that later was copied all over the world. So I believe that the whole thing that we've been sold from the time we're kids is absolute propaganda to justify this idea of expansion of the Roman Empire. In fact, that's why you go to the British Museum today. There's almost nothing Celtic or nothing Britain in it. It's all Roman, 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 Roman. And that comes from the same kind of, shall we say, elites or aristocrats that have existed over the century, who see themselves, and they probably are, direct descendants of the Roman royal families, and by extension the Middle Eastern royal families from Babylon and Mesopotamia and so on. And their rise to power has been given to us as, instead of the real truth, is that their rise to power was a co-option of what took place and was invented on these islands maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago.
The Piso family.
The Roman black nobility.
Yeah.
Near just about every Italian pope since about the 1700s has been a member of the Pizzo family, or Italian black nobility, including Pope Lucius, who was the one who was the Pope during the, I think that was his name, Lucius. It was, don't quote me on that. The Pope during the time of the Third Reich, and he was the one who signed off the Reich Concordat basically threw away the Catholics in Germany. Now, what's interesting about him is that he was a big time member of the black nobility of Rome. These people, yeah, you're right. These people, they show up time and time again, and they're rewriting the history of humanity to actually make us believe that they're like almost like the gods of the rest of us.
Sure. Yeah, God men in human flesh. But the Pisos, once again, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this or have ever come across this, the idea. I'm guessing you probably have, the Piso conspiracy, which ties into the whole business of who Christ was and how the New Testament came to be and so forth. Do you know much about that?
I don't believe Jesus Christ existed. I think he was invented by the Council of Nicaea, just basically a handy deity. There was probably some guy in the Palestine or Judea at that period the Romans crucified lots of people, and there was endless numbers of Hebrew Hebrew radicals at that time. So there's probably basically someone based on that idea. I don't believe he actually existed. I think he was created purely by the Council of Nicaea. In fact, they know he didn't exist because his whole backstory is Mithra, it's Zoroaster, it's all these other deities that already existed in that region. Jesus Christ is nothing more than a copyright trademark for the same idea that's existed for about 2,000 years before he even came along.
The whole business, of course, of the missing year is very intriguing. Although, I'm not sure if you know, he did have a family, though, apparently, too, whoever this character actually was, and that Paul actually actively persecuted and worked to hunt them down. As, in accordance, there's an emperor named Domitian, I believe in the 2nd or 3rd century, around the time of Council Nicaea. He's the emperor, as I recall, of Rome, and he actually issued a decree whereby the bloodline of Christ was to be exterminated. They were to hunt the descendants of Jesus down and eliminate them. So, and it's apparently never been rescinded. So that's interesting if you tie that into a lot of the intrigue through history and so forth. It's worth considering, I guess. At least I'm not sure if it sounds like you might not be top of your list of priorities as far as reflecting upon and giving some thought.
Well, if he didn't exist, how could he have kids? That's the way I feel about it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So there you go. We got to backtrack a little bit here because you've really covered a lot of ground there. What was the name of this? You said like Doverland or something. The name of this Western Atlantis, the Scandinavian Atlantis, tying into the whole Ragnarok mythos.
Doverland was basically a plain, and it's described in the Nordic tales as the Plague of Vigrid. Now this plain existed. And it's a real place between the north of England, Yorkshire, Northumberland, that part of England, and stretched right across the North Sea, well, where North Sea is now, to Denmark and northern Germany. It went down about 5,000-6,000. It went down about 5,000-6,000 years ago. It started to sink. It started to sink around then.
Could you spell that, Thomas? I can't. I don't know. I'm not too clear in the spelling.
Doggerland. Doggerland.
Doggerland, okay. Oh, there we go.
It's been known for centuries that it used to be above sea level because fishermen in the North Sea would be pulling up mammoth tusks in their nets when they were trawling the bottom. In fact, at one time, biggest source of ivory in the world, just because of the mammoth tusks down there. And so it sunk, and so it cut Britain off basically from Europe. It also would have been a phenomenal catastrophe at the time it happened. Now, if you look at the Nordic story of Ragnarok, you have basically the final battle where the old gods die, you know, the Aesir gods die, in one final mighty showdown on this plain of Vigrid. The actual world sinks beneath the ocean after this thing called the Midgard Serpent basically causes a gigantic tidal wave and destroys the land. This idea of a massive tsunami is also very common in Irish mythology. Now, this tsunami came in. If you look at the Mid-Atlantic Rift, there really is a Midgard serpent that wraps around the world. It's where all the tectonic plates on the planet join. It's the most volcanic active region in Europe. It's also where its eyeball would be Iceland, one of the most volcanic active regions on Earth. That's exactly where its tongue and its eyeballs would be. Jeez. And that would be, if there was ever going to be massive earthquakes and volcanoes, that would be written down in allegory as a giant serpent splashing in the sea and spouting fire. It would be Iceland. Now, this place, Doggerland, sank below the sea. They're now starting to find more and more signs of human habitation in there. It's very possible and very probable that they'll start finding megalithic stone circles, dolmens, and the whatnot down there. This was part of the same Atlantean culture. People in the past didn't have, you know, psychology like we did. What they had was folklore. So they transferred things into allegory. So they didn't have the language to describe a tsunami, but they would say a giant serpent in the sea splashed its tail and covered the land in water, and it sunk to the bottom of the sea. Now, in Ragnarok, what happens is that the land comes back up from the sea again, which suggests survivors, and the world of men begins in earnest. Now, this is very, very interesting because this ties in very nicely with the 2500 BC idea that perhaps, like as Joseph James said in his book, The Bicameral Mind, that people started to develop their ego, or should we say a conscious mind, around that time. It seems to have happened all over. 2500 BC is a very interesting time around the world, particularly in this part of the hemisphere. It's when there was definitely climatic changes on a vast scale. You had the desiccation of the Sahara Desert happening around that time, turning to a desert, well, basically a fertile plain to a desert. You had basically the end of the great pyramid building of Egypt. It came to an end. And the megaliths of Europe, of Western Europe, the Stonehenges and so on, the final phases of them were finished around that time. The really big ones now. And it's also around the same time that the Nessa Brodgar in Orkney also became depopulated. Something colossal happened in Western Europe. And it's been speculated, and it's something I completely agree with, that in order to survive and go on from this horrific catastrophe, human beings developed a conscious mind. Not just they couldn't think before these times, but they were basically, they operated like when, for instance, when Carl Jung first went to Africa and met tribes like the Dogon, what he was surprised by was they didn't think as individuals, and they didn't even dream. What they had, what he called a minds that were free association, in that they all kind of shared the same consciousness. Basically, one thought was everybody's thought. This allowed enormous building projects to happen, such as the building of the pyramids or the ancient monuments of the ancient world, because you'd have like almost like humans that were functioning similar to how bees would be in a beehive or ants would be in an anthill. After 2500 BC and this catastrophe that this is probably also the root of the biblical flood, this catastrophe that happened, human beings, in order to survive, have to develop a kind of an ego, another conscious mind on top of that, in order to survive, in order to find, you know, otherwise they would have fallen apart. And I think when they talk about these things of like what happened in 2500 BC, it was almost like the beginning of the modern human as we know it. This is when things like allegory and folklore, a good example is cave art, rock art.
Right.
Before that, if you look at the rock art of the prehistoric, I'm going really far back, we're talking about the Paleolithic artwork of, say, southern France. It was very, very, very distinct shapes of animals and people, very well-rendered, realistic things. After 2500 BC, the rock art and the cave art turns into things like hatches and circles and spirals. What had happened was human beings had developed the ability to translate codes. And that was probably part of this 2500 BC shift.
Swastikas too, let's not forget.
Swastika is one of the oldest symbols on Earth. And what's a swastika divided into? It's a quadrant that's divided into four, just like the Celtic cross.
There's the four again. As much as you might not like to hear it, the four noble truths. So
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, it's the Buddhist kind of
No, I'm not against Buddhists. I just don't know anything about it. I can only devote myself to what I know, what I'm interested in.
And that's what we're gonna continue talking about here today. And you're doing a great job. I'm enjoying myself, as are a few of the listeners. It seems Brig Denholm. Stating that in the text chat here via YouTube, she's loving this episode so far. Joe Eminon, yarg. So, Patricia Murphy has joined us. Haven't seen her around too much to this point, but who knows? I'm not sure. Is she a fan or follower of yours, Thomas?
Patricia Murphy? Oh, Patricia, I know her name from my Facebook page. So, yeah.
Okay. The Scribe?
There's a lady who comments on my Facebook post now and again, yeah.
Let's see. You know, we haven't heard from Pirate Larry in a while. This might be a good opportunity for him to jump in, and he's had a chance now to hear a lot of discussion and a lot of information and ideas being presented and unpacked. Pirate Larry, any thoughts?
Well, it's a wonderful discussion, you know, and it's very enlightening. I think, you know, when you have the freedom to explore other cultures and their roots and what they contributed to the world. It just proves that, you know, people that say history is written by the victorious are wrong. You know, there's kind of a DNA memory that goes back with people, and they remember and they tell their children and grandchildren, and the stories don't get lost. I've always thought about Atlantis. You know, there are ancient civilizations that rose and fell. The Olmecs, you know, in they were a black civilization, you know, Latin America, and they actually did come across and populate Louisiana and the South before there were, you know, even Europeans in the United States. There were ancient calamities. There were people that survived them. And, you know, they kind of brought their cultures with them, and the, you know, dominance culture, or, you know, those who strive to, rewrite history and remain dominant, you know, these are the cracks that make them fall apart.
What you said there, Larry, about, remembering, you know, what you said, those kind of ancestral memories. That's very, 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 very important. We have these codes in our DNA or in our cellular memory from our ancient ancestors. And what happens is when you go to these places where you have like these stone circles, or you go into these caves, or you go and see this ancient rock art, what happens is it's almost like unlocks those codes. Right. That's happened to me. That's what happened to me. I mean, you know, I grew up in an urban environment. I never really knew anything about you know, ancient monuments until I was 11 years old, and he took us to Newgrange, which is one of those famous, like, megalithic, Neolithic sites in the world near Dublin where I grew up. I was 11, and he took us there in school. And honest to God, when we walked into that passage chamber, and the tour guide for the school showed us the ancient rock art at the back, I swear to God, it switched on something in me that has been with me for the rest of my life. It's really about remembering. You know, that's what it really is about. And that's a very good point you brought about the ancestral memory, because we all have this in us. We all come from somewhere, no matter what our racial background is, ethnic background. We all come from something magical that came from something magical to begin with. Doesn't matter if your ancestors came from Africa, South America. It doesn't matter. That magic is always in there, because it was that initial spark of magical, primal, shall we say, what's the word I'm trying to think of?
Gestalt.
Magical, yeah. the initial charge, right? That has echoed through our beings from that moment that happened, and it's really about remembering.
What of the whole idea or business, you know, phenomenon of reincarnation? Do you acknowledge that as being potentially a real thing, or
yes.
is Yeah, so, well, serious, maybe to speak to that then, within the context of what we're discussing here at the moment. How does that
reincarnation
work?
Reincarnation is the default afterlife story in just about every culture until the Abrahamic religions came along.
Right.
The Abrahamic religions were the first ones to come along and say, there's a God in a heaven and a hell. Before that, reincarnation was the default position for all spiritual traditions on this planet, not just in the Hindu world or the Buddhist world. In the Celtic mythology, you have the idea of something called a somla, where the somla is the very essence of the living person or creature. And basically, a human being is reborn through different, not only different people, but different animals. And they always return back to where they need to come from. So, for instance, there's a story in the Asian Irish mythology of, say, a woman having a baby. The baby dies. The somlat, or the essence of that baby, may go into a salmon. She may catch a salmon one day and eat the salmon, and it's transferred into the mother, and it becomes the somlat, or the soul, of the next baby she has. It returns back to mother. Now, this idea, now we have tremendous evidence for reincarnation. Just the stories of children. And you see, one of the things they try to knock, you know, this is a big Jesuit thing. They try to knock reincarnation by saying that everyone who ever says they reincarnate claims they were Napoleon or Cleopatra in a previous life. That's completely untrue. The vast majority of reincarnation stories are people who have lived humble lives, ordinary lives. That's the vast majority of them. The most compelling evidence of all are the situations where parents, one day, their little child, maybe one or two, will turn around and say, "Oh, mummy, I used to work on a ship and I fell overboard and the sea took me." And the parents become very frightened, or says one day they're driving with the kid in the back seat of the car and he goes, "Oh, daddy, I used to live down there." And the sad father said, "What do you mean you used to live down there?" "Well, I was an old man in the house down the end of that lane." And they drive down the lane and he says, "Yeah, it was a greenhouse and it has two columns in the front and I died in there." And they go, "Then it's the house." So there's and parents often get very frightened when their children tell them these stories, and they discourage it in the children. Reincarnation is something that there's tremendous evidence for. I totally am down with it. It is the default spiritual position for all, just about every spiritual tradition on this planet. And it was deliberately, shall we say, destroyed by this Babylonian cult that came from the Middle East 2,500 years ago. In fact, they even had early on in their tradition, if you look at what they came from, like all the Abrahamic religions, they originally came from things like Canaanite paganism. Even the early days of their religions, the early traditions had reincarnation in it. It was only when power structures like the Romans took them over and things like that, that they actually killed the idea of reincarnation. But it's the default position. Absolutely, I believe in it.
Seems to make sense, yeah. What you're saying there resonates with me on this end, almost 100%, really. So, isn't it interesting too? You're talking about the children. So many kids seem to have these experiences, as you've pointed out. And there's a lot you can stories, documentaries, and the like you can find on YouTube and whatnot. It makes you really wonder what exactly is going on. But as we grow, you know, many of us, maybe you yourself had this experience yourself as a child up until the age of who knows what, maybe, you know, 6 or 7, when things tend to change within us. But people, kids with imaginary friends, for example, or yeah, having some, as you say, these past life recollections, and just children just seem to be more open or receptive to, I guess, because of the innocence is perhaps part of it. And that, in turn, of course, is what makes them vulnerable and targets when it comes to the darker side of humanity and these cults and groups that, like the tie into, you know, things like Pizzagate and whatnot, where they try to practice these strange forms of black magic or what have you, using children as their, you know, focusing, using, is trying to, I guess, drain their magical energy for whatever reasons.
Yeah, it's a very sick thing. It's it is the ultimate form of black magic, if such thing as black magic exists, pathological sorcery, if you want to call it that. Do you remember that cretin. What was his name?
Seville.
No. The American kid, guy.
Johnny Garish?
Jerry Fogle. He was used to sell
Subway
sandwiches. That creature, right? Just out of probably just to punish myself. I read it. I went and looked on some of the letters that he wrote to the FBI agent who stitched him up. Remember, he was caught on a sting. An FBI agent pretending to be a pedophile basically brought him down. And the emails that he sent, you know, this guy should not be allowed to live. If anyone wants to kill him, has my permission. He talks about raping young boys in such a way that he's describing some kind of spiritual quest. This brings home what these cretins from Catholic priests, by the way, this is a huge problem. It used to be here in Ireland, from Catholic priests to all these other weirdos and freaks out there who do this kind of thing. It is absolutely, even if they're atheists and think they're driven by a secular, you know, lifestyle, they actually are. There's something about that disgusting act that they harvest something from the kids. I don't know what it is, but it becomes addicted to them like a drug. It becomes like a drug to them. And I think that these people are possessed by entities. And these entities basically feed on human energy of some kind. And what's the easiest one to get? Well, you know, all pedophiles are psychopaths. They'd have to be a psychopath to do what they do. So a psychopath basically has no, it's just business. It has no morality. It just does what it wants to do. And so I really think the idea of an entity makes a lot of sense in these cases, that these people are actually possessed or something.
Right.
I really do believe that. And this entity wants basically human energy, human emotional or psychic energy. Now, you can't push an adult. What's the most powerful force on this earth? It's the sex instinct, sexuality. This is the most powerful thing that a human being can do. It creates life. It has other kinds of qualities to it as well. It is a form of, you know, it's a form of an alchemical process produced by our biological functioning. What, you know, if you were a demon and you were to actually possess someone and you wanted this all the time, you're not going to spend all your time going to nightclubs and trying to pick up women or trying to get money to go to prostitutes. No, you will target children because they're the easiest ones of all, because you can just basically do it, you know, they can't fight back. And sorry, you can just play with their heads and stuff like that, which is what the demons like to do. This guy, Jared Fogle, this creature, this monster, reading those emails, it was just like, I was just struck by how this guy was basically, pedophilia to him was some kind of sanctified religious evangelical personal experience of an enormous enormous energetic nature, and they're absolutely vile, you know. Yeah, and that's why they can't be cured. They just cannot be cured, because whatever entity is inside them, it wants to feed constantly.
They need to be exorcised, is what it sounds like.
I mean, I don't even know if it would work.
You know the word saint, of course. It means if you look at it, it's root word sanitation, clean. Sane. So you're basically, essentially, your inner spiritual house has been purged, and there's some real good stuff going on in there. But Crowley, we haven't brought his name up, but you're talking about ritual sodomy of whoever you could, you know, kids or adults or whatnot. But apparently, I think, as I recall, that was part of his sex magic sort of philosophy and lifestyle. But just keeping that in mind, if you want to address that, the other point of this business of demonology, I think you might be somewhat familiar with this, because I was listening to some of your interviews that you've done with other people and other shows just in the past and in the lead up to things here. But the word is eudaimonia. It's a Greek word which essentially means the good demon within. Or a lot of people like to just call it happiness, is how they see it. But I, myself, I'm totally on board with this concept of, yes, we do have responsibility. I'm not sure if you really made that point or not, but that's kind of my take. Is that, yeah, we got to take care of ourselves, our spiritual well-being, our mental well-being is all kind of tied into it. And that if we open ourselves up and allow this crap to come in, it just builds and builds and grows and essentially, it takes on a life of its own. We become We are possessed, I do believe, with this business. And the ancient Greeks, once again, I think they understood that with the good demon within. But it's, you know, we've really got to work with that and live with that and do the best we can to wake up and kind of, you know, see things as they really are, which is something I think you might be able to relate to, given your rather kind of Gnostic background and history. Would that not be fair to say?
Well, the term is daimonic, and yeah. It's a Greek term that basically means the active part inside of us.
Right.
Basically, it's like the psyche. There's the psyche, and then it's the daemon. Mm. And if something goes wrong in the person, the daemon goes for a walk. It becomes an exterior force. Now, Carl Jung called this shaitonic. This is what the phenomena he called it. Basically, a problem in a life, even a psychic breakdown, a nervous breakdown, causes this split. And the daemon leaves the person and becomes almost like the ghost that haunts your own soul. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think I like the idea of this kind of idea of a daimonic resonance where you are actually being the demon that you're actually, say you think you're possessed by a demon or you're having trouble with the demon. I think the demon is quite possibly in some cases could be you yourself. Your shaitonic part of your personality has basically been split from your psyche and it's outside of yourself, attacking yourself from the exterior forces. I think the reason why this, when a daemon becomes pathological, it has a desire to go, to be free, to be no longer entrapped in the psyche. This is why it expresses enormous hatred for, if you look at any sort of like exorcisms that took place, they express enormous hatred towards the person that they were possessing. This could be the daemonic aspect, like wanting to break free, deliberately inciting, I might add, a Catholic priest or some other cleric to perform an exorcism. This is why the Catholic Church go to extreme lengths, and this is why I'm very wary of all these, like, these professional and sort of like superstar exorcists you get within the evangelical churches in America who perform like 5 exorcisms a day. Reason why the Catholic Church go to extreme lengths not to exorcise a demon is because it releases the demon, it releases the daemon from the psyche and makes the thing free in the world. It basically creates a feral entity that roams free in this reality. So it's an interesting idea. I think, yeah, the Greeks were definitely onto something big time, big time. Mm. They definitely had a lot more knowledge in this stuff than we would have today or even since Christianity came along.
I'd like to circle back, actually, just do a little backtracking here to what had been hit on earlier regarding, well, we didn't go too much into Malta, and I know that you have done some exploration and personal visitations and trekking and to that area, that part of the world, but there's not just Doggerland, for example, there's been, on top of that, many multiple undiscovered and sunken, lost, I'm not sure if continents is the exact term, probably not, but cities and civilizations all through Cuba, I think, is an example. You got Yonaguni, which over in Japan, and it's just countless everywhere. I'm sure you can probably rattle off a few yourself. But are we not, given this, with this being the case, things like the Google satellite GPS system and that sort of thing, that we're living essentially now through the age of apocalypse, which once again, it just means an uncovering or a lifting of the veil. It doesn't necessarily mean some huge military conflict or battle. Some people would like to have us look at it that way, but just an awakening. Spiritual awakening.
Yeah, and that's all I see as the literal meaning of like the skin being opened up and the truth revealed. Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, talking about those sunken continents, like Graham Hancock about 15 years ago did that wonderful TV series Underworld, mm-hmm. where he went on diving expeditions to all these places.
Sure.
I mean, that was like that show was a huge hit in this part of the world. That was a mainstream show. It was on Channel 4 in England. And that was a huge hit, that TV show, and it really got people excited and interested. And so you had millions and millions of people watching that show and suddenly amazed that they didn't, you know, they're finding out the sunken cities all over the world. This is something they were never taught in school or no academic will ever teach them. Knowledge will out. It's coming out in all kinds of ways. Yes, the internet is playing a major part in it, but people have to be receptive to it. This stuff has always been around if you wanted to go look for it. But people a sizable number of the population had to be receptive to it. And they're being receptive now. So it was a case of not that the secrets had to come out, but the population a sizable percentage of the population had to be at such a position where they were ready for it. And that's exactly what's happened. I find, like, in my work, I've got, like, one foot in the mainstream and one foot in the alternative. And I'm finding that more and more my mainstream audience are coming around to Fortean or esoteric or out there ideas, because I think of the way I present them. I don't tell people this stuff is true. I don't barge in saying, you know, that this, that, and the other is definitely true. I present the stuff in such a way that they'll find it interesting. For instance, my main way of teaching people about ancient civilizations is through mythology and artwork. Everyone loves a good story and everyone loves a good picture. But I was going to run in there screaming about the Anunnaki and they're coming back on Planet X and all this nonsense. That would just frighten the mainstream people away. And they'd be right to run away because it is nonsense. But if you go in and talk about, like, how rich our ancient cultures were and what we have to learn from them, and you can point to something like Stonehenge and you say to them, you know who built that? And they'll say, who? Your ancestors built that. The same blood that runs in your veins built that. And if you talk to them in those kind of ways, you find that they open up and they suddenly find their own magic narrative to apply on top of that. So it's all about how you tell people these things and approach it. It's been very, very badly described until very recent times. And now I think people are getting better. There's lots of interesting books and documentaries and films people are making. Just like that Graham Hancock Underworld series. That was a beautiful example of how to do it properly.
Sure. And there's been people such as yourself, of course, everyone lending a hand, doing their part in their own way, whether it's through books or documentaries or what have you. Michael Tesserian is another. I'm not sure any names that come to mind, colleagues, people that you respect.
There's lots. I like Anthony Peake. He does a lot. I like his work very much. Mm-hmm. He deals with the mysteries of the quantum universe, the matrix, the nature of reality, and things like that. He'd be a good one to have on your show, actually. He's a nice guy and a really good talker. I like people like Robert Bruval. I like people like Graham Hancock. I'm quite traditional in that scope. I'll pick up something off most of the others here, there, and now and again. There's a guy called Mark Ory in England who wrote a book about the Green Man, and also he's been on Greg Moffat's radio show, which Legalized Freedom. He's done some talks on the missing Roman legions. He's someone new that's come on the scene. I quite like what I've heard from him. And there's bits and pieces here, there, and everywhere. But ultimately, I think it's important for people not to get bogged down in listening to me or anyone else all the time, and get out there and start exploring for yourself, because the ultimate truth seeker, the ultimate guru in this stuff is always going to be yourself.
You are the Buddha.
You are the one waiting for. It's as simple as that.
Exactly. Now, speaking of Robert Bovall, Zahi Hawass, I'm not sure if you've caught this or not, but there's a big blow-up or blowout or brouhaha when Graham Hancock, they had, scheduled to do some kind of presentation or maybe like a debate of sorts, basically, and Zahi Hawass just lost it when he saw the name Robert Bovall. And did you pick up on that or catch that at all?
No, the next time I know all about that guy. He's an interesting character, to say the least. I don't know. The next time I'm chatting with Robert, I'll ask him. I don't know. I didn't hear about that.
Oh, boy.
But it doesn't surprise me. It's not the first time.
Yeah. So it looks like we got about 20 minutes in accordance with the allotted 90-minute time frame that we lay out for ourselves here, every installment, every episode. So there's a few things. You hit upon the Green Man. That's something we could maybe take a minute or two to explore. Why the hell not? You know, the ship that we are sailing on here today out across these brave digital waters, it's been christened the Robin Hood. So maybe a bit of a tie-in there, perhaps. Robin Hood was a kind of a green man of sorts, was he not?
Yeah, this is I find this idea of there's something very deep about English folklore and mythology, and it's a connection to the woodlands. connection to trees. It's something I've started to develop a big interest in the last few months, this idea of the ancient English soul, its connection to the woodlands. And you have like Herne the Hunter and Herne's Oak, and he's a kind of a Carunus, Zerunus type character. He's the god, or he's almost like the embodiment of the ancient English forest, in the same way John Barleycorn is the deities, the embodiment of the field, of the, you know, the god of the fields and stuff like that. And the idea, I've been very interested in woodlands and this kind of thing, and more, but the idea of the English kind of connect, the ancient English soul. You know, every souls are generally rooted towards like some kind of landscape. So we say the ancient English soul, from what I can see, is very much geared towards the forest, the woodlands. And so is the, and that probably comes from the Germanic as well, because the Germans would have been the same, the Anglo-Saxons. So you had that connection. But the green man is almost the archetypal embodiment of the creation of the English identity from Anglo-Saxon to what you would call the English today. He's like almost like a guide for the development of that archetype. He's connected very much to the idea of the wood being a protective place rather than the wood being the woodlands being a dangerous place. Remember, in times past, forests were considered extremely dangerous because of wild animals and stuff like that. You wouldn't have ventured in them. I mean, human beings used to live on the coastlines for thousands of years because they simply couldn't go inland because the forest, everything in there will see you as a food source. And again, it probably happened this 2500 BC thing. It took an almost quantum leap for early humans to make this migration from the coastlines or from the river deltas into the woodlands. And in order for that to happen, in a specific case of the English, they created a god of the woods, this idea of Herne the Hunter. You know, even it's also very, very heavily rooted in the idea of Odin, you know, Odin, a Wotan, the same deity of the god of the north. And he's also heavily connected to the woods. Then you have the Druids, the idea of the grove. The grove was the space in the woods. There was where the chapel really was, where the actual sanctified, that word again, area of the spiritual kind of involvement, but also legal and other things. Druids were much more than spiritual advisors. They were lawyers, storytellers, politicians, genealogists, the works. And the green man is the embodiment of this relationship between the ancient English identity, and specifically, although you have other versions of it in Germany and around the world, but specifically in the English identity, of the connection between the human and the forest. Again, he's like the intermediate soul, the intermediate daemon of a sort, between the connection between humanity and the woodlands. And it's a really beautiful thing when you think about it. It's a really beautiful idea that you have this guy who's in the woods that's almost like a wood spirit who's actually taking care of you. He's there for you, but he doesn't encroach upon either you or the natural world. It's almost like he's almost like a Rosetta Stone of understanding the woodland existence.
Right.
And then from that, now Robin Hood is an interesting one too as well, mm-hmm. because Mark Ory in his book, The Green Man, talks about how people used to cover themselves in copper ore, actually powdered copper, as a way of keeping infections down. It was a way of keeping, when they would go into the woods, they would cover themselves in copper. And this would stop insects from biting them, and also would give them a lot. And then what would happen is their screen, you know what happens to copper when it oxidizes, it turns green.
Right.
And these guys would actually turn green. And they would actually be in, their skin color would be the color of Lincoln green. And this is why they were so successful in beating the Romans in England. It's because these fellas, the Romans would stand there in their red tunics and their polished nettle. And these guys just would basically come out of the woods, attack them, and vanish into nowhere. And they were literally green. They were green men. And that's, Robin Hood is probably the allegory of Robin Hood, although there seems to have been a real Robin Hood, but the actual idea of this Robin Hood and his merry men of the woods being in Lincoln green comes back from the same idea of humanity's early, shall we say, seeking sanctuary in the woods.
Fascinating and profound. I'm thinking, of course, too, the Green Man, as with Robin Hood and Maid Marian, would have presumably had a archetypical consort or counterpart, a female partner.
In the Irish tradition, it's an entity called the Sheel in the Gig.
Ah.
If you go around Irish homes today, you will often see in the rural areas, but it's quite common. Actually, because it's just becoming very fashionable and trendy again, part of the apocalypse. She's a pagan deity, although she was incorporated into Irish Christianity. And what it is, it's a representation of a woman with her legs spread apart, and she's holding her vagina wide open.
Oh, yeah.
So her vagina is the same, is prominent as her, is as big as her head. This was the Sheel in the Gig. Now, basically, she is the female representation of that idea of the nature spirit, the nature god, or the nature deity. Interesting idea that her vagina is actually shown as a portal. It looks like you're walking into another world. There's a growing belief among neo-pagan circles in Ireland and in other parts of Europe, and I like this idea a lot, actually, is that the white light when we die, that we see when we die, is actually the light coming through a vagina that we're being born from, the next life. And so there's a theory, and I like it a lot, that the Sheel in the Gig is a reminder that you will be born again when you die.
How about that? Very symbolic, of course. And a representation, I would imagine, too, of fertility. Fecundity is it's a word people might want to get their dictionaries out and look up. But, that sort of thing. We're going to have to just try to clip on through a few topics here just quickly. The lost Roman legions that you alluded to earlier, what's just a quick overview or breakdown synopsis? What's the deal with that whole story?
Basically, well, you should get Mark Ory on. This guy's interesting. O-R-R-Y is his name. I spell his second name. He's written a book on it, and basically I don't know the guy. He doesn't know me. I'm just a fan of his books. Basically, they went to England and they just vanished. They were destroyed. Basically, that's it. But there's some other great theories that they went to Ireland. Ireland was never conquered by the Romans, although the Romans settled here on the East Coast kind of peacefully as traders. They never conquered Ireland. And there's also the theory that they were wiped out in North America, that he may have had good enough ships to get to North America and were wiped out somewhere down in Virginia or somewhere like that. And it's a very interesting idea. I forget the number of the legion. I think it was the 10th. I forget the name of the legion, the number of the legion. Don't quote me on that.
Right.
But it's an interesting story. It's an interesting story. They literally vanished off the face of the earth. And the Romans kept meticulous records of military service when legions were dissolved, when legions were, amalgamated into other legions. They literally vanished from the history books.
What kind of numbers are we talking exactly? How big of
I think it was it's like 10,000 troops or something, isn't it?
Wow.
I think it's 10,000.
How about that? Now, was it just one legion, or was there several that disappeared?
Oh, just one. One specific one. And it was, I think they were originally a Spanish legion. They were actually recruited from Romans and Spanish territories where Spain and Portugal is now. I think that's where they came from. Yeah. No, they just vanished out of the face of the earth.
How about that?
Oh, quite spot off records. Other records. They never existed.
Just going back now, because we're trying to just hit on, once again, a few talking points here before we wrap things up. Circling back to this whole business of megalithic culture and whatnot, we were talking, just once again, the pre-interview yesterday, briefly discussing this business of how South Korea, where I'm presently based out of, although we are, of course, today broadcasting from out of international waters on the Robin Hood, that the South Korea claims to contain or possess, have here on the peninsula, some ridiculous amount of the world's dolmen. The Korean word actually for dolmen is go-in-dol. Go, you can look at that, I guess, in the go sense, going, as you alluded to earlier, with this vagina business of the afterlife and rebirth and whatnot. You're going in, because it's used to a lot of times mark representation of death and so forth, and in, which means person in Korean. It's interesting suffix, something to really keep in mind and reflect upon, because it's American and Canadian and Italian in Korean. It's the same in means hanguk in, meaning person. There's a lot to that. There are a lot more examples that we could come up with at some future date and just kind of map out for people. But yeah, it's something like 60 or 70% of the world's dolmen. What's the deal there exactly? Have you heard much about that?
That's interesting what you said about the meaning of the word in Korean, because the traditional name in Ireland for a dolmen was a portal dolmen, which was the name, because they had at the front and they had basically a door, like an opening.
Giant rock is literally what it means here.
That's funny you said that. It means basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, see, in Ireland, it's a bit, dolmen's thing is a bit weird, because a lot of them were actually central chambers of mounds that were covered in stones. And all you have left now is the dolmen part, which is a central chamber. And others were actually standalone dolmens that were built like the three or four stones holding up the big, you know, the big capstone on top.
The
big slab. So there was two types, definitely. The Korean dolmens are phenomenal. I mean, I was looking at some of the pictures of them. The masonry, the stone and the cutting and the sheer size of them is colossal. They're immense, and they're probably the most impressive ones I've seen anywhere. I've never seen them in the flesh, but anywhere in the world. Hmm. But yes, it's incredible. The dolmens are everywhere. They're all over Russia. They're all over Poland. They're everywhere. I've seen them. Are dolmen type structures where you have the top slab stone and they're held up by the orthostats, the upright stones underneath. You're right. They're everywhere. It's like almost like a compulsion that humans have been driven to create this from the earliest people they were.
Mm-hmm. Something very profound, I would imagine, going on historically with respect to some ancient world culture of some kind. Even I'll give you a quick example that there was a famous king of the Gaya Confederacy here in Korea, right down to the central part of the lower nib or tit of the peninsula. And his name is Kim Sudowang. He married an Indian princess from India. That's how the story goes. So you can imagine with something like that. And it's around the time of Christ. And, you know, they founded this confederacy down there. And there's a lot going on there, which I'm not going to get into too much detail here at this particular moment. We're going to book and schedule a show we've got lined up here at hopefully not too distant date from now, go into a little more detail there regarding all kinds of good stuff, the Silk Roads and just the transmission and cross-fertilization of ideas and so forth with respect to Korea and places like Afghanistan and all kinds of, India and whatnot, of course. So some really profound and amazing stuff there, for sure, in a really big way. And a lot of things that people don't know about. So this is, you know, once again, time for maybe folks to reflect upon, consider, think about, and work on investigating. Edinburgh, Roslyn Chapel, we've got to touch on that, of course, too, because you had a really profound experience there, I guess. Somewhat disturbing and troubling from the sounds of things. What's your relationship with Roslyn Chapel, and what happened?
A bunch of students from Edinburgh. I did a talk at Edinburgh University in 2012. It went down really well, and some of the students the next day said, "You want to go on a little holiday out to Roslyn Castle?" And so they. All these lovely young people from the university took me out there, and it's something I've always wanted to see. From an architectural point of view, I'd never really had any interest. I just thought it was a church. I never really had that much interest. And there was a guy there with us on the way out, was telling us, wait till you see this place, wait till you feel it. He says, this place is much more than just a church. There's something really strange going on there. It's a very strange, it's a very beautiful, ornate building. It's basically what you see of the church today. The chapel was basically the first part of what was planned to be a gigantic cathedral that was never built. So what you're seeing is basically the start of a cathedral. That's why it's so ornate. It was supposed to be a major European cathedral to rival, you know, Salisbury Cathedral in England or the Dom in Cologne in Germany, or that kind of thing. When I went in, what struck me was there were so few windows, yet the place was flooded in natural light. I could not figure that out. How this building had so much natural light inside it from so few windows. It's quite small. It's basically like a small parish. It'll be a small parish church in terms of its size. It is incredibly ornate on the inside. The masonry and stonework is out of this world. Some of the carvings on the columns are mind-blowing. So I'm going around and I'm saying, okay, this is very nice. I'm enjoying this as a kind of a touristy, architectural kind of day out. And then they brought us down into the crypt. Now, if you're standing, say, where the pews are, and you're looking at where the priest or whatever the vicar is giving the service, where the altar would be. There's two sides of the altar, the left and the right. On the left-hand side, there's nothing. It's like almost like it's kind of like a box, a kind of a window, a kind of I think they said the baptismal font was in there at one time. On the other side, on the right-hand side, there's a door going down into what they call the crypt, but it's not a crypt. There's no burials or anything down there. It's basically a room below the ground. Well, as I was descending the steps going down, I was overcome by the most ferocious psychic attack I'd ever had. It was horrible. I felt like my soul was being pulled out of the bottom of my feet. I'm going, okay, this is interesting. So you go down there, and there's this thing called the Master of Terrors. And it's like, it looks like the death card. It's a skeleton with a side, like the Grim Reaper, just a skeleton body. And on either side of this kind of frieze he's on are two humans screaming in terror, like holding their mouth, like, stop torturing us, this kind of thing. But what's really interesting about this crypt and this lower sub-basement is the walls are covered in microscopic or smallish, about the size of an American quarter, pentagrams, loads of them. And all kinds of other weird shit like that. Sorry, I mean, of course, all kinds of other stuff like that.
It's a pirate ship, Thomas. Don't worry about it, man.
On the walls. But yeah. Beautifully done. Yeah. And the story is, that's where the masons practiced their skills at cutting stone. If they could cut down a finite shape like that. And I was like, what a load of bollocks that is. They were clearly a ritual. This was a ritual environment. These were magical pentagrams. In a magical setting. We were in, but they were on the wall, and here's where it gets really spooky. They were on a flat wall, and you got the same impression there was something behind that wall, and it wasn't very nice. When you go back upstairs on the right hand side of the altar, where it's just like basically a box or an opening, myself and a lady that I was with and a friend of hers put our hands. So she said, put your hand in there and tell me how it feels. It was like putting your hand into the air above liquid nitrogen. It was absolutely freezing the air around this. So cold, in fact, that you felt it, and I've never felt a cold thing like this before. It was spreading along my arms like it was infecting me like a disease. And then the guy who's with it, he claims he was a Satanist. I don't know if he was or not. He was definitely into the occult and stuff. Basically, from what I gather, underneath that altar is an entity. Maybe the great demon himself. We don't know. Under that floor is down there. And that's what's behind the wall. And that's what was walled up by the Sinclairs. They brought it back from the Middle East. It's a box or some kind of entity. And it's inside it. Now, is that true? I don't know. Have I seen much evidence for it? No, except that I literally had to be carried out of that church by two students from the college, from the university. And I had to go outside, and they told me to hug a tree, which I had to laugh at. The idea of tree hugging, you laugh at it. But I did. I put my arms around the tree, and I started to feel normal again. Roslyn Chapel is the most toxic and evil place I've ever, when I say the word evil, the most energy-zapping, creepy place I've ever been to in my life. And I've been to a lot of strange, I've been down caves in the center, way down in the Ireland. I've been in the Hypogeum in Malta, which was a very strange experience, but nothing was like Roslyn Chapel.
The Star of David is said to be, or it's the Seal of Solomon, is essentially what it is, and it's said to be, on one level at least, some sort of a demon seal of some kind. You're talking about the stars in Roslyn Chapel and whatnot.
The story in the Goetia and the Lesser Key of Solomon and the magic books, these shapes are apparently attracted to entities in fact, you know, King Solomon used what they said to build a second temple. He utilized these demons from the Middle East called the jinn, which is an Islamic idea.
Right.
And basically how you capture them, and it works, is you use these symbols basically to attract them. The Star of David is, it's you go look for the origins of the Star of David. It's very difficult to find. It's a very difficult one to pin down. If you look at the shape itself, it represents the crossover of two dualities, the two triangles inverted. So automatically there you have a very powerful geometric shape, and it gives itself, it lends itself with a circle around it to, you're drawn to the shape. It's attractive. You meditate on that symbol. I have a few of them at home. You meditate on that symbol. Like, you start staring at it and look at it. You find that it has a tremendous power. That's why you see it on Masonic lodges and stuff like this, or Masonic schools. In Dublin, where I grew up, there's a very famous girls' Masonic school, and they have an enormous Star of David, or whatever you want to call it, Seal of Solomon, in stained glass on the front of the building. There's a hip, and I believe when the Masonic school was open, they would have, now these girls would be nearly all Protestants, and they would be all Protestants. And when they were in, so among their classes was to take a half an hour every day to actually meditate on the stained glass window of this symbol. And so these symbols have tremendous powers, very, very powerful. And that one is an extremely powerful symbol. That's why it was adopted by Kabbalists. It was almost like the key to protect the Jews and European Jewry in Europe. It became after the 1700s on, it became the default sort of symbol for European Jewry and Hebrew Jewish traditions. But that's the earliest we can find. If you go back to the earliest synagogues in, say, Palestine, you'll find things like swastikas on them.
There we go. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you actually next, is how it ties into the swastika. I know a little bit about that, believe it or not, as far as the history goes and its relationship with the Nazi, that whole thing. But just briefly here, because we're just trying to, we're going to try to wrap things up in the next couple minutes. There's something funny going on there on an esoteric level with respect to the Star of David and the swastika. That's no coincidence, I don't think, that those two symbols were chosen and the way that they kind of play off of each other.
Because the swastika is a very special symbol.
Right.
It's one that you can actually, it has no power by itself, but the power that you apply to it is extremely powerful. You understand what I'm saying? It's like a battery, it's like the most powerful battery in the world, but it remains uncharged until you put an archetypal or an energetics meaning or symbolism towards it. You'll see it on Celtic monuments in ancient Portugal and Spain. You see it everywhere. The Hindu world, of course, it is the symbol of the Vedic world.
Yeah.
The Nordic people say the hexen magic of Northern Europe, the magic of the European witchcraft tradition of Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Finland, Germanic countries. To them, it was the sigil of Tor in perpetual motion, spinning around the sun. Some speculation also in places like Finland, it was seen as the Big Dipper, or what you call it in America, or the Great Bear, as we call it here, the constellation of Ursa Major rotating around the pole star. I really like that one a lot. That's a great theory. But it's basically a dead symbol until you apply a power to it. When you apply the power to it, it's a quadrant, so it's got the same kind of power as a Buddhist mandala, just like the Celtic cross have. When you have the quadrants, the four things, it also can be used to represent the four functions of the psyche, intuition, intuition, feelings, and so on. And in the center, you have it's the same idea as the center of the Rosicrucian cross, the dot in the middle, the absolute point of the unknowable God. See, these symbols are so incredibly powerful and so huge that to actually, when someone says to me that the swastika is a symbol of the Nazis, as if that's the only thing it ever was, I know I'm dealing with a complete idiot. Okay, that's like one of my yardsticks for idiocy is when somebody finds swastika offensive. Swastika existed before. That's like finding metal offensive. You know, it's like finding coal offensive, you know, right. Just it yeah. has no, you know, just not. It's a resource. It's a psychic resource. I mean, you have a situation now where you have absolute idiots, cultural Marxists, who are trying to imply that swastikas from the ancient world were actually Nazi. Now we can't have a swastika from 2,000 years ago from Portugal, or 2,000 years ago from the Indus Valley, or 2,000 years ago even from an early Jewish synagogue, because they're Nazi. This is how stupid people have become. Yes, the swastika is a ferociously powerful symbol, and we have to take it back from the Nazis, big time. It has to be. One thing I would love to see in my lifetime is the swastika reclaimed from the Third Reich.
Absolutely, and I think we're both on the same page as far as that is concerned. It's said to be an ancient, among other things, an ancient Aryan sun symbol. So let's just leave it at that there for now, other than to perhaps add to that how it was no coincidence the way that these symbols were selected, and in particular the swastika and how the Nazis used that, and that the impact that it did eventually have on people's thinking, as you've pointed out here, and the way so many have been essentially dumbed down, and it's just, you know, this form of mental enslavement and ignorance, really. So, but we've pretty much hit the time limit here. Just quickly, then, going back to Roslyn Chapel, as I had alluded to or touched on in our brief discussion yesterday, as we were doing a little bit of audio check and so forth. I spent a couple of days actually across I think it's called Roslyn Valley, just across the way there at a location, a little estate called Gordon Place was the name of it. And there are all kinds of, I was invited there. It was downtown Edinburgh at the time. The Fringe Festival was in high gear. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, they were scheduled to perform during the Fringe, and I managed to take that in. Actually, I'd been on tour throughout Europe, and kind of a bit of a fan, kind of stalker type. So in the end, though, as things turned out, was invited to stay at this Gordon Place location out just once again across from Roslyn Chapel. Stayed there for a couple of days within the midst of these artists and fire, I guess it's like circus acrobats and musicians and, you know, just seekers of all sorts. So it was a great time. But one of the things I told you about was this business of going down and exploring the caves in the valley, and how the story that had been brought to my attention was that it was William Wallace and his men who were hiding out there during the reign of whichever, I think, British monarch, English king.
Edward Longshanks was the king of England.
Right. Now, you mentioned the name Robert the Bruce. He and William Wallace they worked together. I know very little as far as this history is concerned, but weren't they kind of, they were allies, were they not?
Yeah, that was his king. William Wallace is just a soldier.
Sure. But they apparently, the story goes that they were, William Wallace and his men, they would hide out right there, right at the base of Roslyn Chapel, within these various cave structures throughout the valley. So, as a means of evading capture at the hands of the English. Was it William Longshanks? Is the name once again of his
Edward
Longshanks? Yeah, his
he was Norman.
So yeah. I'm sorry, he was Norman.
A Norman, yeah. I think, well, the Normans were running England that time.
Sure. And what was the time frame there exactly with the era of William?
1300s.
You're breaking up a little bit there. I'm sorry. One more time.
1300s.
Ah, there we go. Yes. So 1066, of course, was the Battle of Hastings. And that whole business where William the Conqueror, I guess, just swept, came into Britain with his forces and troops. One, just a quick, Pirate Larry, do we have you there still? I'm not sure. We haven't heard too much from you as of late, but I think, have you seen the captain today at all, Larry?
I haven't seen the captain, but I hear he's over at the Mossy Wench. Which is where we're going to after the show.
Yeah, and which is going to be just in about 2 to 3 minutes from now. So you haven't seen the captain? Well, oh, hang on. No, we're getting an update. The captain is, in fact, on hand. Just a minute, folks. Yeah, Captain Long John Sinclair, stand by. Yeah, send him over here. Tell him to stop. No, he's got to cut back on his drinking, okay? Just, yeah. All right, sober up. Okay. Yeah, 2 seconds, gentlemen.
Ah, yeah, that's my Captain Long John Sinclair here. Welcome aboard the Robert R. Thomas. It's great to have you a part of things today. How's the stand-up comedy going these days? I think we may have lost Thomas.
Oh, I didn't know you were talking to me. Sorry.
Yeah, Thomas, the stand-up comedy. That's but on top of that, though, let's not forget the name Long John. Captain Long John Sinclair. There's a bit of a family connection. The ancestors from the Roslyn Chapel, of course, the Sinclair clan. So, yes, indeed. Direct descendant here. But let's leave that aside for the moment, if you wish. It's totally up to you, but really, we just want to extend our thanks. It's a great pleasure and honor, in fact, to have someone of your scholastic ability and knowledge visit us today aboard the Robin Hood.
Well, that's the first time I've been interviewed by a Dalek. Yeah, thanks. It was good being on.
I'm sorry, a Dalek? Dalek?
A Dalek. You don't sound like a pirate. You sound like a Dalek. You know, like the robots from Doctor Who.
Well, I'm not sure. We'll have to do a little bit of a sound check maybe after the show. Maybe work on improving things. But anyways, Pirate Larry, episode 49. Chaffee, well done. We'll be off to the Marcy Wench, and we'll see you gentlemen in a few minutes out.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Captain.
I am Captain.
Yeah, so, yeah, much appreciated. No, he pops in from time to time there. You have to, I'm sorry, that's hopefully not too, he was a little bit, he's into the sauce a little bit today, as he typically is, so. But we're, yeah, just working on winding things up here. Thomas, thanks once again. It's really much appreciated. We've got a little bit more. If you're going to be able to stick around with the after show, the feature end of things, the Rogues Gallery, as we like to call it here, as we make our way over to the Mossy Wench, maybe talk about a few different issues, including gaslighting and Jonestown. So if you've got a little bit of fuel left in the tanks there, the afterburners, keeping that in mind. We also, our listeners, want to know a little bit more about what sort of links that you've got to share with us, where we can find you, if you've got any major events coming up. Of course, you have the May symposium. Anything else you'd like to add to that as far as people being able to contact you or where they can find you?
My website, thomassheridanarts.com, is one, and my other website, streetdruid.net. They can get everything that I've ever done on either one of those two websites.
Streetdruid.net. That's a new link there. So we have not come across that one to this point, but we'll be sure to add it to the show notes. ThomasSheridanArts.com. And Triskelion. That's a swastika reference there, kind of a bit of a callback, as it were. But maybe we can go more into that, of course, in the after show. But the Triskelion being the three-pointed swastika, is that correct?
Yeah, three spirals.
So you've got the Triskelion Dragon .blogspot, which is quite, there's a lot of great content over there as well, too. Thanks once again to Alchemy Doll, a.k.a. Suzanne Isles, who helped to put this interview together and, you know, reaching out to Thomas and making a little bit of magic happen here today for show number 49. Let's not forget, too, as well, people can find us on YouTube, Twitter. Podomatic, of course, is where we've got our PayPal set up. People enjoyed what they've heard today, the content and discussion. They can pop by there and maybe, get, you know, we're always open to tips and donations, subscriberships, and all that kind of good stuff. So right now, unfortunately, Google and the AdSense that we are working on having set up via our web domain, WPRPN.com. Bit of a snafu there. I'm not sure if we're speaking of gaslighting being messed with or not. We'll have to play that one by ear. Baja Bands as well, too, let's not forget. Pirate Larry, why don't you just give a quick little shout-out regarding Baja Bands, and we haven't heard about that in a while, so you can tell people what might be helpful for them to keep in mind, be aware of.
BajaBands.com. You can get it on your iPhone or iPad
or you can go to our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/BajaBands. That's B-A-J-A, like in Baja, and B-A-N-D-S, like in Rock Your Socks Off. And they've got a lot of great music there. It's all independent music. And we're all about building bridges instead of walls, man. Music talks to people worldwide. And these are world-class musicians, so check them out. Here's some new stuff.
Building bridges.
Thanks for letting me have a plug.
Yeah, you've been doing a yeoman's service here over the course of the past number of shows. We have our 50th episode coming up here next week too. Let's not forget. So let people keep that in mind. We're going to have open lines as well as work on maybe having a few former guests pop back in for, you know, like an update or what have you, just to touch base. Also been getting a number of text messages coming in from former guests. So a lot of discussion next week as far as where we've come from over the course of the past number of episodes, where we stand at the moment, and, of course, where we hope to map out and steer the ship over the course and duration of the balance of our journey. So future shows including the Hawaiian Church of Elvis, Minds.com co-founders John and Bill Ottman, hoping to have them back before too long, and Sticks and Hammer 666. So we've got we're going to close things out here with Sal Caruso, pretty active over on Minds.com as of late. He gave us permission here to use one of his songs as an outro for today's show. What we've selected, thought it would complement today's discussion quite nicely with Mr. Thomas Sheridan, is Putting on the Armor, Shield of Faith. On behalf of the Robin Hood and all its crew, tally ho.